Welcome to the SDF conferencing system.
There are two other parties in this conference.
This is Publius, bringing you A Step Farther Out, weekly radio message from the Man at Adams Society. What do I have to talk about today? Well, I have a couple of thoughts which I would like to share with you. There may be somebody out there who has listened to my previous broadcasts where I have talked about people saying that such a thing was the will of God and being very dismissive of that and thinking, you know, am I blasphemous? Am I against religion? Actually, I don't think so. What I'll say is this. People have a tendency to look at things and assume that they can't be changed. And when they assume that those things can't be changed, why? What's their response? They file those things under the will of God, or the order of nature, or the human condition, or they say, that's just the way things are. But, as I've repeatedly said, in the past 100, 150 years, indeed, since 1700, when Newcomen's engine came on the scene, many things which we used to take for granted, many things which our ancestors took for granted, have changed radically. Does that mean that the human condition has changed radically? I don't know. I think people are still pretty much people the same way that they were 300 years ago. And as for the order of nature or the will of God, those things would also seem to be, if anything, more unchanging than human beings are. Human nature, the human condition, whatever that is. Just a thought to ponder. Also, I'm sure someone wants to say, why are you always talking smack about wind and solar, about renewable energy? You don't make any friends talking like that. Indeed, if you go, for example, to the Reddit nuclear group, you'll find one of their rules is, you know, no nuclear versus renewables debate or something like that. Well, here's the way it is. A lot of people really believe in wind and solar as the solution for the future. And that bothers me because I don't see where that confidence is justified. But that's not actually what I'm mostly interested in. You see, wind and solar, because of the way they behave, are great counterexamples. If I want to describe what I think is the way that we assume energy needs to be supplied for our civilization, wind and solar make great counterexamples because they absolutely do not behave that way. Now, what do I mean when I say that? Well, here's a good example. There was a story in the Frankfurter Allgemeine, which is basically the German equivalent of the New York Times, this was back on Tuesday. The situation may have changed since then. But according to this story, from the end of May up to that time, 16, 17 days, there had only been 2 days during which German wind installations had produced any meaningful amount of electricity at all. Only 2 days in over 2 weeks. And one of those days happened to be a sunny Saturday when demand was slack, and for once the solar installations were actually producing. Now, think about that for a minute. You often hear people say, oh, well, battery storage will solve all the problems that are associated with intermittency in wind and solar. Battery storage? I don't think people are thinking in terms of battery storage, which will carry you for literal weeks. Think about it. If you had to depend on this wind power, you would need batteries which could last for weeks. It could carry your whole energy usage. You know, and I'm not talking about, oh, well, you know, you can run your TV for an hour a day. You know, you can run your Wi-Fi router. I'm talking about being able to run your dishwasher, right? And your laundry machines. And your dehumidifier. And your kidney dialysis machine. And your CPAP. This is not a trivial problem. Well, because these are not energy sources that behave in the way that we expect, people fall back on energy sources which do behave in the way that people expect. So happens that wind and solar output in Germany is down about a quarter from, you know, year-to-date versus previous year, year-to-date, right? So what's up? Well, coal. Coal has accounted for 26% of all kilowatt hours generated in Germany so far this year. Nuclear is only 14 because, of course, the German government has been requiring nuclear power stations to shut down. Now, in regards to that, recently the German Constitutional Court, the Bundesverfassungsgerichtshof, if you want to be formal about it, issued an opinion saying that the slow pace of the transition to non-carbon energy, non-greenhouse gas-emitting energy, was a violation of the government's responsibilities under the Constitution for environmental protection and the safeguarding of the common welfare. Okay, then, what is the consequence? Well, Dr. Glaubitz of the Free University of Berlin, who is physics in the physics department, but some of you may know him as a Debian developer, wrote to the Bundesministerium für Umwelt, the Environment Ministry, and asked them, you know, in light of this decision by the Constitutional Court, are you at all reconsidering the requirement for all nuclear power stations to shut down by 2022? To which their response was basically, oh, don't worry about it. As long as all nuclear plants shut down by 2022, we'll be on the trajectory to close coal power plants by 2038, and everything will be fine. There's no discussion, of course, of millions of tons of carbon dioxide emitted a year, right? There's no discussion of what is actually going to provide the energy. And remembering always that electricity supply is only a part of the overall energy supply, right? Now, what is going to take the place of fuel oil? Because I can tell you right here, right now, as an absolute fact, that fuel oil is the dominant source of heating in German homes. Well, the government is saying you're going to all install heat pumps. Heat pumps, of course, mean they consume a good deal more electricity than oil-fired furnaces, particularly oil-fired furnaces running steam radiator systems, which don't even involve air circulation blowers. So that means a requirement for more electricity and dependable electricity, because people don't want to freeze to death in the winter, generally speaking. And particularly because in a climate like that of Germany, heat pumps are not something you can just hand wave. The coefficient of performance of heat pumps depends very much on the temperature they're dumping heat into, which is typically your house, and the temperature they're getting heat from. And if that's the outside air and you have a prolonged cold snap, the heat pump doesn't perform as expected. You know, they're fine in a Mediterranean climate. They're generally fine in the climate of Texas. But do you know what you have to make up the difference when the source doesn't provide enough heat? The answer is electric resistance heating. Electric resistance heating, which is, of course, the most inefficient form of heating available. But what other choice do you have? Of course, mind you, I've also seen Germans burning coal in their homes. So here's my question, right? Are you looking at the means to get things done that comport with the things that you actually say you're going to get done, right? Are your means and your ends consonant? And basically anybody who says, oh, well, you know, wind and solar, that's energy of the future, and they, you know, that's very generally accompanied by an unwillingness to ask that question. Means and ends, right? Give you another example. You know, I was on the Coast Starlight going up the coast of California in the dining car, seated across from somebody from Portland who told me that, oh, well, you know, Germany's 100% solar now, which I had no luck in explaining to him that that's absolutely not true, not in any way, shape, or form. And he also, you know, when I said, you know, we've got a billion people in the world who've never seen a light bulb. A quarter of the world's population has no meaningful access to electricity at all. And even those who do, it's fairly small. So, for example, the Indian government considers a village electrified if a village of 100 people has a single 10-amp outlet. Well, you can bet they're still having to do their laundry by hand. If you've ever done laundry by hand, you know it's back-breaking, tiresome work. It's just not a good scene all around. But the fellow I was talking to said, oh, well, you know, a simpler life like that is really a better life, isn't it, than our, you know, materialism. And I thought, try it sometime, buddy. So there's some discussion here in SDFCOM, and they're going back and forth about, you know, we have the question often raised, what do you do about nuclear waste? Well, of course, the counter question that I have is, what do you do about fossil fuel waste? The answer is we dump it directly into the Earth's atmosphere because there's so much of it that there's literally nothing else we can do. And then, of course, the proportion of it which is not gaseous, right, vast quantities of stuff build up, right, like the ash piles at coal-fired power stations. Now, here's a fun thought. All of the spent nuclear fuel in the United States, 80,000 tons, right, 80,000 tons of spent nuclear fuel could be buried under the ash pile, cinder pile, at any of a number of coal-fired power plants without even being visible. These ash piles are enormous. Now, people often talk about nuclear waste, and the plain fact is, in my experience, generally speaking, nuclear waste is not what people think it is. That's all there is to it, right? When you discharge fuel from a nuclear power plant of the types we currently use, what is it composed of? Well, 96%, 95%, we'll say, 95% of the discharged fuel is uranium oxide, the same thing that went into the reactor, because only about 5% of the atoms that you load in, 4 to 5% of the atoms fission in the course of the fuel cycle. So you have 95% uranium oxide, which is still about 1% enriched. It's got more uranium-235 in it than the natural uranium as it comes from the ground. Then about 1% is plutonium, and about 4% is fission products. Now, to give you an idea, just backtracking a moment. So in a kilogram of nuclear fuel, as it's used in today's reactors in the United States, 40 to 50 grams are burned up in the course of 12 to 24 months. Each gram that's burned up, as it's called, each gram of material fissioned yields a megawatt day, a million watt days of heat. You're talking about a million to one versus fossil fuels. And of course, the spent fuel, being uranium oxide mostly, has a bulk density about 10 times that of water, meaning it gets very compact. It's also, of course, a resistant to high temperatures and corrosion and so on, because if it weren't, it wouldn't be any good as reactor fuel. All that by the wayside. So 4%, let's say, 4% of the spent fuel actually consists of wastes. 1% consists of plutonium, which is reactor fuel. 95% consists of uranium, which is reactor fuel. And 4% consists of fission products, which are wastes. Now, some of those fission products do have some industrial, scientific, or medical use. But we can consider them all to be waste. Fine. What's the characteristic of them? Well, why do we even care about them? Well, they're dangerous because they're radioactive. Right? They're dangerous because they're radioactive. But radioactivity is the release of energy as an atom goes from a more energetic to a less energetic state. So as that radioactive decay, as it's called, continues, then the energy that drives it goes away. So the fuel is, the spent fuel, or then specifically the fission product wastes, are becoming less radioactive all the time. In fact, they lose more than 90% of their radioactivity, typically, in the couple of days between when you shut the reactor down and when you take the lid off. And then you take those fuel elements out and you put them in a cooling pond, and they continue to lose radioactivity. Because most of the fission products, particularly those with a high decay energy, are very short-lived. In fact, there are only two fission products that are of real concern in this regard. See, the thing is that because of some weird twist of nuclear physics, there are two groups of fission products. Fission products are all what we call beta-gamma emitters, which means they emit energetic electrons. When those electrons get slowed down in a medium, they produce X-rays. Also, the nuclear transitions emit high-energy photons, gamma radiation, which is like X-rays. So they're an external hazard. In other words, you can be harmed even if you're not touching them, even if you don't ingest them. Okay. But what do we know? Well, there are two groups of beta-gamma emitters in the fission products. One group has half-lives exclusively less than 30 years. The other group has half-lives longer than 100,000 years. Then the second group is things like iodine-129 and technetium-99m. There's been discussion over whether technetium-99 could constitute a hazard under some really unlikely circumstances. Iodine-129 is essentially harmless because it's got a very long half-life. So in a sample of it, the number of decays per second is small, and the decay energy is very low. So really, the fission products of concern are all in the group with half-lives of 30 years or less. Now, if you hold a sample of mixed fission products for 300 years, even the longest half-lives, and we're talking strontium-90 and cesium-137, which, as it happens, do constitute a significant fraction of all fission products, they're several percent, those have decayed by 2 to the 10th power at a minimum, right? So they're at least a factor of 1,000 below where they were when you took them out of the reactor, and we can basically write them off as having completely disappeared. This is important because it indicates that much of what people say about nuclear waste, you people say, oh, well, it's toxic for 1,000,000 years or whatever. It has to be isolated from the environment for 1,000,000 years. You've got to ask people, where does that come from? Where does that number come from? And it turns out they just sort of make it up. It doesn't mean anything. Now, if you are trying to dispose of spent nuclear fuel by itself, then the largest energy contributor with a long half-life is undoubtedly plutonium-239 with a 25,000-year half-life, which means 10 half-lives of that would be 250,000 years. That would be the longest that you'd have to store it before the stuff was no more hazardous than an equal amount of natural uranium. But to be perfectly frank, that's an insane thing to do. It only makes sense if you've already decided you're not going to use nuclear energy. If your reason for not using nuclear energy is the difficulty of disposing of the waste, and the only reason it's difficult to dispose of the waste is you've decided not to use nuclear energy, there's a flaw in your reasoning. Circular reasoning is not going to help you get out of the hole that you're in. Now, doubt is expressed in calm. I don't think it's an argument between fossil and nuclear. I beg to differ. That is exactly the argument. If you want to know why that's exactly the argument, ask the question, where are photovoltaic cells produced? Everyone, for some reason, is depending on photovoltaics as the grand energy source. I don't understand this. You look at the 1970s, the interest in solar was primarily focused on heat collectors, which have much, much smaller raw material requirements. They can typically be made of plastic or something lightweight, which consumes relatively little energy to produce, produces relatively little toxic waste, etc., compared to semiconductor silicon, which is a nightmare. But the fact is, your PV panel, generally speaking, over the course of its lifetime, for every kilowatt hour that it produces, about half a kilowatt hour of electricity was invested in making it. That's not a particularly good thing to start with, but then you have to ask, well, what kind of electricity goes into making PV units? And the answer is dependable, reliable electricity, bulk electricity at relatively low prices, something that PV doesn't really supply. Solar cells aren't made with solar power. Typically, they're made in China. They're made in China using electricity derived from coal. Coal which is burned without any environmental protections.
There are 3 other parties in this conference.
Every PV panel that you put on your house represents a whole lot of coal burned in China, a whole lot of toxic waste dumped directly into the environment. I think a lot of people, if they thought about that, would realize that this isn't perhaps the best deal they've ever heard of. In fact, it's kind of a sham. There is no reason to think that wind and solar can support an industrial society. If we're going to have an industrial society, the energy sources really come down to fossil, which is self-limiting, firstly because of its waste products choking us to death, and secondly because the supplies, the ability to extract the supplies, are not really adequate to go much further in world economic and social development than we already have. The third possibility is space solar. Space-based solar is an entire different world from ground-based solar, because you can put your collectors in an environment where they get full-strength sunlight all the time. Then, of course, you have to transfer at least part of that energy to Earth. Depends how much of your industry you're willing to shift off of Earth. But that's going to take quite a while to implement. 100 years, probably, at a minimum. I have friends who think it could be done faster. But I have doubts. I think that's a big challenge. And therefore, what can we infer? Well, then we have to infer that the real choice is between fission and fossil, and that fossil isn't a really good choice. And to give you a just sort of qualitative note on this, several years ago now, actually, the Tennessee Valley Authority finally completed and brought online a nuclear power station which had been delayed for decades. And at that time, a local newspaper interviewed various business people and so on about this, and one guy actually said that he was going to put in a photovoltaic solar manufacturing factory now that he had a big source of large quantities of cheap, dependable electricity. Yes, there seems to have been someone else who called in, which I really question. But here's the... So this is the thing. See, also the question, wouldn't it drastically change climate on Earth if you suddenly shade the planet with solar panels in space? Well, you could. People have actually considered building giant sunshades to change the climate on Earth, just as people have also considered building giant orbital mirrors to focus sunlight on the surface of the Earth in places which they thought wanted more energy. Both of those are very, very difficult. Most discussions of space solar talk about installing very large orbital units, typically in geosynchronous orbit. I've even talked about doing it farther away than that. But geosynchronous is convenient. Then, of course, as I say, depending on how much of your industry you move into space, part of that energy has to be relayed down to the Earth, which typically is done using microwave beams, the same kinds of frequencies we use for communication satellites, because they pass through the atmosphere without significant attenuation. Now, a consequence of this is that your antennas, both transmitting and receiving antennas, have to be several kilometers in diameter. But on the other hand, the ground-based antenna can look, it doesn't have to look like much. Basically, it can be a cattle pasture with poles, and then slung from the poles are wires about 3 meters up so that cattle don't bump into them. And the microwaves, you know, it's basically wire mesh is what receives the microwave energy. And then that's rectified and then inverted and then fed to your grid. And so you can basically turn a 2 kilometer diameter circle somewhere in the vicinity of town into a gigawatt power plant that supplies electricity, you know, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. There are, of course, disadvantages to this plan. Someone asked me once upon a time, well, what about migratory birds? And this is a question, of course, that has to be asked. As we've seen the giant bird barbecues of some solar thermal facilities, this was several years before the Ivanpa solar thermal plant opened that became infamous for setting birds on fire. But somebody asked, well, what happens if migratory birds pass through the beam? Now, the real answer is not much, because the intensity of the beam is only similar to the intensity of sunlight, and if birds get too hot, they typically fly in a different direction. But what I said was, pop some like popcorn, why do you ask? Because I am a person of questionable morals and taste. But that doesn't mean that I'm not going to suggest that you support me by sending payments to paypal.me/PrometheusLives. And it also doesn't mean that I don't have enough good taste to tell you that coming up in less than 10 seconds is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe, which airs at 19:30 UTC every day on a non-radio. Goodbye. 7.